This is Susie Mazzoli, and you're listening to Light on Conspiracies.
I'm convinced that it is one of the most unjust wars that has ever been fought in the history of the world.
Welcome back to Light on Conspiracies, the second part for subscribers only.
I'm here with my friend Mike Williams, and in this second hour we're going to look more into the mystery about Paul McCartney or Paul McCartney. Is he really the same guy that was part of Beatles before 1966, or was he replaced? That is a major mystery. And while I'm at it, I just want to point out that all the music we're listening to in these podcasts are made by Mike himself, so congratulations with that. Okay, Mike, so please, when it comes to the Beatles music, there's a lot of rumors saying that they were not actually the ones that wrote their own songs, but that this was done by sources within the Tavistock Institute. What is your opinion about that?
Well, that's a theory or a rumor. Theodore Adorno is who these researchers claim is the person that was writing the early Beatles material. I don't know if that's true. I really haven't found any hard and fast research that says that Theodore Adorno was penning the Beatles music. The one thing I can tell you is that I remember, even as a, you know, listening to Beatle music when I was younger, that some of the music that the Beatles were writing, considering their age, seemed out of sync. So in other words, Paul McCartney wrote the song For No One, and, you know, he was maybe 23, 24 years old when he wrote that song. But it's a very sophisticated song from the standpoint of relationships and life experiences. So I'm not saying that Paul McCartney, I'm talking about biological Paul McCartney now, not Bill Shepard, I'm not saying that he could not have written that song. I'm just saying that it's songs like that that make you take a step back and pause a little bit and say, 23 and 24-year-old person, I mean, do they really have that experience within them to write that type of song? I don't know, you know. So it's given me reason to pause and reflect on, did they write all of their music? Did they not? I tend to believe, and again, this is just a hypothesis on my part, that I believe the Beatles wrote their music. But I do not discount the fact that they got some help, professional help, when it came to perhaps putting some of those songs together. Certainly, the production, having George Martin as their producer, who is a very high-level Freemason, there's a reason why they got teamed up with George Martin. And if you take a listen back to the Beatles' music, and I'm sure you have, only the early recordings, those recordings are impeccable. They are impeccable. Versus if you go back to some of those other bands at the time, as an example, if you listen to the Rolling Stones or some of their early recordings, they were not impeccable. In fact, a lot of noise on the tape, and you know, the production value just was not there. I mean, especially when you compare it to the Beatles. So I don't know. I don't know about Theodore Adorno, whether he was writing all of the music. I don't know if he wrote any of the music, but I do not, again, discount the fact that maybe they got some help along the way. But I tend to believe that Lennon and McCartney wrote their own stuff. They first came on the scene, only they were a boy band. That's what they were. They were a 1960s boy band, and they were writing, you know, just straight up rock and roll. In fact, on a lot of their very early albums, like Please Please Me, Meet the Beatles, and so on, Beatles for Sale, there's a lot of music on those albums which were not written by Lennon and McCartney. They were written by other artists. So yeah, they were doing, you know, straight up rock and roll. And then with the advent of Rubber Soul, when Rubber Soul hit the scene, there was a drastic change in the Beatles' music. And then, of course, that led into Revolver, which built upon Rubber Soul. And then from Revolver, we went into Sgt. Pepper, which was the first album that Bill Shepard played on. So, yeah, I completely understand what you're saying, that the progression of the Beatles' music and the songwriting became much more complex. And, of course, people will say, well, of course it got more complex, Mike and Ole. It's because, you know, these guys were in the studio all the time, and they were playing, and they had time to be creative. So, you know, this music just organically evolved that way. And I guess, yes, that could be. But, you know, when you take a listen back to some of the early albums, and you listen to what they're doing on Rubber Soul and Revolver, you know, it's a pretty stark difference in sound and in quality. The Beatles were at the forefront of Tavistock's manipulation and social engineering of the masses. So what they do is, and I know you know this, is they do everything very methodically and incrementally. So they start at a certain point. So when they first came onto the scene, you know, the Beatles had their mop tops. And as you and I both know, that in the beginning that, you know, there were those in the audience that were paid and compensated to react the way they were reacting, the screaming girls and stuff like that, in order to create the demand for them, right? So you had all that going on. Not all of that was organic, and that, you know, some people might be disappointed to hear that, but that's actually come out now, that, you know, people were paid to participate in a frenzy. And then, you know, in 1967, when Shepard took over the reins of the Beatles, because he was really the leader of the Beatles in 1967, when once biological Paul either died or was replaced. That's the other thing. I just want to make a point that, I do not discount that maybe Paul didn't die, that he just stepped out and he was replaced by Bill Shepard. But clearly, Shepard's mission was to bring in the psychedelic era. And they did that with Sgt. Pepper. And Sgt. Pepper is, to this day, considered the psychedelic album of all time. Not only just an unbelievable staple in rock music, and is consistently voted, you know, by music critics and listeners alike as one of the top 25 albums of all time. But the main purpose of Sgt. Pepper was to introduce the psychedelic era. The level of orchestration and engineering is mind-boggling. And so when you understand that the secret societies, the controllers, they own the music business. They own the entertainment business. They own your media. They own academia. They own your governments. So they own it all. It's a brotherhood. It's a brotherhood of secret societies, with the, you know, the overarching predominant one being Freemasonry. So we all know that, you know, the Kennedy assassination was a conspiracy, and you know this more than anyone. You've been on my show to talk about this at great length. So when you start to talk about the Beatles and you understand that the Beatles were a Tavistock project, well, then I'm going to say that it just wasn't happenstance that the Beatles came out when they did, that it was timed appropriately to come out right after the Kennedy assassination.
So Mike, there's been a lot of rumors about the night when Paul is said to have died. And one of the things that has come forward is that the MI5 or MI6 was part of a meeting that night together with the Beatles, informing them about what had happened, but also what was going to happen. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know about the MI6 or the MI5 piece of it only, but I can tell you that based upon the information that comes out of the memoirs of Billy Shears by Tom U. Harriott, that there was a sequence of events that took place. And let me just give you some of these dates, and then I'll roll into the Masonic connections, because in the book, Shepard, he clearly states that the Beatles, along with being a Tavistock project, are a product of Freemasonry. It's just a Masonic entity. And again, a lot of people are not going to want to hear this, but, you know, once you start researching it, you start rolling through the evidence and the facts and the clues, I mean, it's pretty obvious that it's there. So, again, as I mentioned, in the book it states that he died on Sunday, September 11th, 1966. And here's where it gets really interesting. The very next day, September 12th, Brian Epstein meets with Bill Shepard and brings him on board. Now, Shepard is also known as Billy Pepper, or Sgt. Pepper. He was known as Billy Pepper. He had done some early recordings, Mercy Beat albums, and they were entitled Billy Pepper and the Pepper Pots. And on those albums, he was doing a lot of Beatle covers. Epstein sends John Lennon a telegram. Lennon at the time was in Paris. A lot of researchers say that he was in the studio and that he and McCartney had had a debate, but that's not what a memoir says. Memoir says, no, Lennon was in Paris at the time. So that telegram from Brian Epstein, who was the Beatles manager at the time, who I also believe was a high-level Freemason, probably 32nd, was sent to Lennon on Tuesday, September 13th. So far we have McCartney dies September 11, 66. The next day, September 12th, which is a Monday, Bill Shepherd is brought on board. Epstein sends a telegram to John Lennon in Paris on Tuesday, the 13th. Epstein introduces Bill Shepherd to John on Friday, September 16th. This is 5 days after Paul had died, and they met in Paris, France. When they met, Shepherd had a list of demands, and one of those demands was that he was going to lead the Beatles going forward. Now, one of the reasons for this is because he knew that his life would change forever, that he would have to undergo extensive surgeries, plastic surgeries, the use of fillers, the use of latex. I mean, this sounds very, very weird, but there was latex used in order to create the visual that Paul McCartney was still with us. Now, one of his demands was that the Beatles would not be doing love songs anymore, that they were going to be taking, he would be taking the Beatles in a different direction. So what he means by love songs is in the early Beatles albums prior to Sgt. Pepper, we had a lot of songs about boy meets girl, girl meets boy, relationships, heartbreak, that type of thing there. And of course, there were other songs that didn't deal with that topic, but the Beatles did a lot of songs from 1963 to 1966 that had to do with boy-girl relationships. Shepherd didn't want to go there. He said, no, we're going to change direction. And the direction he was going in, as I mentioned earlier, was the psychedelic era. Lennon was in duress because of McCartney, biological Paul, passing away. And so he agrees to relinquish control of the band. So he hands the control of the Beatles over to Bill Shepherd. And therefore, Shepherd becomes the new leader of the Beatles. Sgt. Pepper is Bill Shepherd's debut album. And he makes it very clear in the book that Sgt. Pepper is his concept, his album, his construct, everything from the concept of having the album, which introduces a new band, by the way, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, to the album cover, to everything. And the album is just loaded up with Masonic symbolism. So that was how Bill Shepherd came on board. And the interesting thing is, Ole, to answer your question, in the book, Shepherd states that he had received extensive training in music. He's a very, very accomplished musician. He can read and write music. He can score music. And this all came about ever since he was young. And he was pushed along by an uncle that was a very high-level Freemason. And Shepherd himself is a Freemason. In fact, his family roots go back to Scotland. It goes back to Scottish, the Scottish warrior that Mel Gibson played in Braveheart. I'm trying to remember the name of the player there. But Shepherd's uncle had called up George Martin and told George Martin that his nephew, Bill Shepherd, is going to be the replacement. That was it. The call was made, the order was given, and that's how it happened. George Martin tried to contact Brian Epstein, and Epstein, he had trouble reaching him, but Epstein had already been notified that Shepherd was going to be the new guy in the band. And this all happened because of the Masonic communications and, you know, manipulation that was going on behind the scenes. So, you know, it's an interesting story because if McCartney died on September 11th, 1966, and the next day Brian Epstein is meeting with Bill Shepherd on the 12th, well, that starts to raise a question about how long was this in the works? It sounds awfully planned.
What is the big problem? If Paul died, why didn't they just say, it's very tragic, Paul has died, but we got a good replacement for him here, the band will continue. What is the big secret?
Yeah, I think that they were concerned about the public reaction to not having Paul in the band anymore, and that the Beatles would no longer be the Beatles without Paul McCartney. The Beatles had become a cash cow for everybody that was involved. So when we're talking about everybody, we're talking about very powerful players. We're talking about Tavistock. We're talking about British intelligence. They were making a lot of people a lot of money, a lot of money. And so they didn't want to risk the possibility that the whole thing would just fold. So I guess the discussions, again, I'm hypothesizing here, could have been, well, we can just introduce this new guy, like you're mentioning, this guy Bill Shepherd, and we're going to say that Paul passed away, and this is the new guy, and the Beatles are going to move on without Paul McCartney, and we're going to have Bill Shepherd is going to be the fourth Beatle. And I guess the powers to be decided that, well, there's too much risk in that. So we're going to have to do something here to disguise the fact that McCartney's no longer in the band, whether he died or he was replaced, and we're going to have to do something to make this guy the new Paul McCartney, make him look like Paul McCartney, sing like Paul McCartney, and so on. The thing is, Shepherd had been in the music business for a very long time. In the book, he mentions that he was known as the man of a thousand voices. And what he meant by that was he was a studio, a session musician, and he played on many, many records, and he would also sing on records, and he would be asked to sing like and sound like certain famous singers, and he was able to do that. And so his being able to emulate Paul McCartney's voice to a great extent, I mean, it's not perfect, but he does a very good job of it. I'm not going to say that, you know, he doesn't sound like Paul McCartney. You know, I can listen to recordings where I can clearly hear that it's not biological Paul, but for the purposes of mass consumption, he did a pretty good job. So they made a decision that they were going to invest in this guy, invest heavily in him. And I think the reason being, Ole, is because it's not just the replacement of Paul McCartney. It was the direction of what the Beatles, of where the Beatles were going to take music as part of the Tavistock experiment, social engineering experiment, which was to elevate the Beatles into the psychedelic era. And so Shepherd was the guy that they believed was the talent that was going to be able to do that. So it gets complicated, and there's a lot of conjecture in there, and not because, you know, we're missing facts. It's just that with the facts given, we're going to have to hypothesize as to why they did what they did. But based upon my research, I believe it was because they just didn't want to lose the money, take the chance of losing the money, and they felt that they could shape this guy to the point with plastic surgeries and fillers and latex and so on, where they can convince the public that this guy is Paul McCartney. And the big way that they did that, Ole, was how Sgt. Pepper hit the scene. So if we think back to Rubber Soul and Revolver, as I mentioned earlier, and if you remember what the Beatles look like on those album covers, like on Rubber Soul, the front cover, you can see the Beatles. They still kind of have their mop tops. It's grown out a little bit. Revolver, of course, the front cover is an illustration by Klaus Voormann, but the flip side, the back side of the album cover, we have the Beatles, and still, they don't look anything like the Beatles looked on Sgt. Pepper. So what they did was kind of a shock and awe. When they introduced Sgt. Pepper, the Beatles looked so different. Not just Paul McCartney, all of the Beatles looked so different. They decked him out in all of these colorful band outfits. The hair had grown longer, there were mustaches, there were beards, and there was this whole, like, psychedelic optical perspective you took in when you looked at Sgt. Pepper. You looked at the album cover. To this day, I still look at that album cover and I think to myself, it's awesome. It really is. It's an awesome album cover. It's so much color, and it's just very striking. So a big piece of getting over that hurdle was that they presented the entire band in a different light, in a different way. And so it overloads the senses, right? I mean, people that are looking at it. And so you're not really picking up on the fact that this guy that they're calling Paul McCartney, maybe we should question a couple of things, you know? He did change. I mean, really, if you look at him, he doesn't really look like the same guy. His face is a little longer. He's taller. We can go through all of these types of anomalies, but very few people picked up on it. And it wasn't until 1969, 3 years later, that it started, you know, hitting the airwaves with radio shows and newspapers, which were questioning whether the guy that's playing Paul McCartney was actually biological Paul or an imposter. And they were able to weather those storms, you know. And the Beatles themselves are just putting all these clues out there. And,
but do you know, Mike,
you know,
do you know
people
when,
were listening to the
marketing
strategy.
I'm very used to look into the mindset of people behind false flags or psyops and intelligence agencies and so on. What it sounds to me like, if I take a step back and just look from a sort of speculating, but from an objective kind of, what if the original Paul McCartney was against this whole thing, going into the psychedelics, going into the mass deception of, and became a sort of a blockage for the agenda. So they decided to replace him. And that's why Billy Sheppard was being prepared in the background for a long time. And then once that happened, if he died or he was taken out or forced out or whatever, because I mean, you can use plastic surgery to make someone look like Paul McCartney, but you can also have Paul McCartney do plastic surgery so he doesn't look like Paul McCartney and can continue living somewhere else.
Right, that's right.
That, because it's like, it feels like this is a major step, a major operation that is much bigger than just replacing an individual.
Oh, it's a much larger operation. They were using the Beatles. Again, the Beatles, as Sheppard mentions in the memoirs of Billy Shears, were and still are a Tavistock project, as were the Rolling Stones and other bands that came out of the British invasion, but the Beatles were their prize. And so, yes, it was very big. It was very large. They planned on doing big, big things with the Beatles. And so I agree, Oli, that there is a theory out there that biological Paul McCartney was not going along with this, didn't agree with it, and so it was like, okay, well, you know what, then you're out, one way or another. So that's why I always say, I don't discount that biological Paul may not have died. He could have just been taken out, replaced, and, you know, put on a shelf someplace or gone off to go do something else. We don't know. But what we do know is that the person that's playing Paul McCartney since 1967 is not biological Paul McCartney. He is not. And if you just take a look at the, you know, I put up a montage, a collage together, showing the different Paul McCartneys over time. So if you looked at any particular picture by itself, you would say, oh, that's Paul McCartney. But when you lay all those pictures against each other, you line them up, you do like a lineup of pictures over time, it's very clear that this is not the same guy. It's not. So, yeah, so I agree, Oli, that this was huge, it was big, and they were going to make sure, when I say they, excuse me, I'm talking about Tavistock and British intelligence, they were going to make sure that this was going to work one way or another. And as you know, I mean, they have all the resources to do this. You know, it's not like they have a budget.
Yeah, and also,
so they're going to do what they need to do to make sure that they pull it off.
Michael Jackson, when you look at the different versions that is said to have been Michael Jackson, and different top politicians, prime ministers, and so on, it's quite normal that they are like 1, 2, 3 backups, you know, that can take care of walking around and saluting the crowd when these big so-called stars don't want to, if they're not feeling like it. I think that is one of the reasons why one of these Michael Jacksons had this mouth, what do you call it, this white mouth protection on. I just think it's because he wasn't identical. And when you look at Winston Churchill, Stalin, all these old warriors, they had multiple doubles.
Right.
So it's nothing. There's nothing new here.
Jimmy Carter.
At the same
Jimmy
time,
Carter's
I think it's the first time it's been done in a rock
band. No, there's nothing new.
And in this scale, at least what we know of.
That is what is the big thing about this. People might say, well, what's the big deal? You know, why are we talking about Paul McCartney being replaced? And what does this really have to do with anything? Well, what it has to do is they took the most popular, one of the most popular musicians at the time, musician and entertainer, and they swapped him out. And guess what? Nobody noticed. And so what does that tell Tavistock from the standpoint of its ongoing experimentation and gathering up of the human psychology? What does it tell them? Well, it says that people see what they want to see, or people see what it is that you show them. And as long as you put some context around it, people are going to believe what it is that they were telling them to believe. And so that's why the replacement of Paul McCartney is very important, because we have been looking at Bill Shepard, an imposter, for 50 years. And, of course, there are people that have been looking into it and everything else, but for the most part, it hasn't gotten any traction. I was surprised, actually, Ole, that how many people were contacting me that really had an interest in this. But still, I mean, when you lay that up against the number of people that believe that the person that they're listening to and watching on stage and so on is actually Paul McCartney, it pales tremendously by comparison. So it's important because it is a big, big win for Tavistock. Because what it says is that, hey, you know what? We took a guy of this magnitude, we took him out, replaced him, or he died, or whatever, and we put this other guy in place. And we dressed him up, and we put him in the proper environment and the proper context, and nobody blinked. So what does that mean? It means, like you said, Ole, that there have been doubles throughout history everywhere, politicians, actors, musicians, and so on. I mean, it's on and on and on. And this basically gives them a lot of confidence to be able to do this type of thing elsewhere. You know, on the world stage as an example, right? So to me, it's very important. Now that I know what I know about it, having looked into it, it's very, very important because it really gives a glimpse into how the world of intelligence and Tavistock
operates.
The length
isn't the same. The teeth aren't the same. The eye color now, he's suddenly from being very brown, now they're almost greenish. I mean, how do you explain that with a different height? And there was also a forensic Italian team that went out to just show that this was absolutely bogus, and they ended up being one of the forces behind getting this out to the public.
Yeah, actually, the Italian team was supposed to have put that together for a major magazine. I forgot what the magazine or who the magazine was at the time. But my understanding is they received a lot of pressure to back off that. And, of course, it's out there today. You know, we can get it on the Internet. But, again, it's tucked away. And unless you are, you know, somebody who's really digging, you're not going to see it. That's how they operate, right? They just bury it. And, yeah, okay, it's out there. But who's really going to go find it? Only the most intrepid. And they'll just call you and me and everybody else that's looking into this as, you know, conspiracy theorists and nut jobs. And Paul McCartney's alive and
well. I think it's really important as well
crazy.
To
I mean,
keep in mind what was going on in the USA at the same time. In Laurel Canyon, how the whole rock theme started right in this little small area with the CIA big base right in the middle, pumping out tons of LSD, setting up all of these massive big concerts and so on. So it's like everything was rolling simultaneous and parallel
yes.
ways on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, you and I talked about this during Laurel Canyon, you know, during that period of time in the 1960s, they had the Lookout Mountain, which was Hollywood's top secret nuclear film studio, right, which was a major military intelligence facility that was right smack there in Laurel Canyon. And I mean, and just so the audience understands, you know, the number of bands that came out of Laurel Canyon, big names, is staggering. We had the Byrds, Buffalo Springfield, the Monkees, the Beach Boys, the Mamas and the Papas, the Turtles, the Eagles, Zappa, Steppenwolf, Three Dog Night, Alice Cooper, The Doors with Jim Morrison, of course, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, Carole King, Jackson Browne. It goes on and on and on.
The
so
area is so
you
small.
You can't keep calling
I mean,
everything
just a tiny little village with a big CIA base right in the center, almost like neighboring Frank Zappa's house.
Right.
And then also all the people that have died around this.
Exactly.
Thing, either blamed on so-called serial killers like Sharon Tate and so on, but also in the Beatles itself. You know, Brian Epstein allegedly committed suicide. You had John Lennon who was shot dead. And it's said that he was just on his way to
yep.
expose this whole thing. And then George Harrison as well was almost killed in his own home, stabbed. So it is, when you look at from the outside, if what you're putting forward here
yeah.
is true, then that makes perfect sense. If there's any leakage, they will try and stop it. Any whistleblowers, they will try and stop it.
Yeah, and Lennon dropped a lot of clues, and I've listened to a lot of John Lennon interviews over time, and, you know, before I really got into this, you know, dug into it, some of the things that he said really didn't maybe resonate with me with regard to Paul being replaced. But now that when I go back and listen to these interviews, he is dropping little clues here and there about McCartney. In fact, in one interview, he talks about the McCartney myth. The McCartney myth. You know, why would you call your childhood friend a myth? Why would you do that? I just put one up on Facebook yesterday where he referred to McCartney and Jagger as company men. Company. What company are we talking about, John? I mean, what are we talking about? We're talking about Tavistock. We're talking about intelligence, you know. So there's a lot of clues. And also the song How Do You Sleep that John released basically tells the whole story. Just basically drops a big bomb in everybody's lap. And everybody, most people just chalk that song up as just a battle, a tiff between him and McCartney at the time, who is really Bill Shepherd. But it wasn't. It wasn't just a tiff song. It was John Lennon in How Do You Sleep spilling the beans best he could without getting himself in big trouble. Because the way this works, Ole, is they have all signed secrecy agreements, non-disclosure and confidentiality agreements. And that's why in the book, The Memoirs of Billy Shears, Shepherd clearly states that the book is what is referred to as historical fiction. And he explains the reason why he has to do that is because if he does not lace that book with some degree of fiction, that he can have himself huge legal issues and he could lose everything. He has amassed a gigantic, and he's enormously wealthy. You know, McCartney today he's a monolithic corporation. I mean, he's huge. He's worth billions and billions of dollars. And of course, you know, he has his children and so on. And so he wants to leave that to his family. So he's not going to jeopardize spilling the beans to the degree where he's going to wind up in losing all that. And he tells the reader this in the book. He spells it out. In fact, he has an entire chapter dedicated to having to pass everything through his legal team, through his lawyers, to give the okay. And then, by the way, the Scottish blue blood I was talking about was William Wallace of a Scottish warrior frame. I couldn't believe I forgot it before. And that is the part that Mel Gibson played in Braveheart. So Bill Shepherd's lineage, blue blood lineage, goes back to William Wallace. So he's a Scotsman. Shepherd is. He's not English. He's Scottish. So in any case, you know, he's very steeped in Freemasonry. He has a whole chapter dedicated in memoirs to the Masonic influence. I think he called it Masonic checkmate in the book. And in the book, Ole, he also describes the Masonic hierarchy, which I found to be absolutely fascinating. He describes the structure and how it works, which, you know, you're not going to find that in many books. You're especially not going to find it from somebody who is a very, very high-level Mason. In fact, I believe he's beyond the 33rd degree. I believe he's in what they refer to as the illuminated degrees today. He wasn't at the time when he was selected to enter into the Beatles. And by the way, he was, I believe, an internal handler of the Beatles. That's what he was. Whereas maybe Neil Aspinall and Mal Evans played that role outside the band. In other words, they weren't in the band when Shepherd took over. He was the handler within the Beatles when he entered into the band scene. But yeah, he talks about the whole Masonic aspect of it, Ole. It's really amazing
that it's actually
what we get into here. And,
like George Harrison used to call him in many different or in several different interviews.
Yeah.
He says it's very specifically fall, not Paul, fake Paul.
Right.
But you're saying that it's the current Paul McCartney that has written this book. Okay, so why is he doing that? I know that he refers in multiple interviews. He speaks about Paul McCartney like as a third person, and it's very strange. You really think that he's either totally schizophrenic or it's actually what you're saying, that he's playing a role. But what would his intention be to put this book out there?
Because nobody knows who Bill Shepherd is. So in other words, think about it, Ollie. He has written all the McCartney music since 1967, since Sgt. Pepper, for 50 years. And everybody believes that Paul McCartney wrote that music. Everybody believes Paul McCartney wrote Band on the Run, that Paul McCartney wrote Live and Let Die, that Paul McCartney wrote Maybe I'm Amazed, that Paul McCartney wrote Let It Be, that Paul McCartney wrote Sgt. Pepper. And the truth of the matter is, it's Bill Shepard. So he's at a point now, by the way, he's 5 years older than biological Paul. In fact, he makes mention of this, of his age being in Magical Mystery Tour. If you go back and listen, he states an age that has nothing to do with the age Paul, the actual biological Paul, would have been at the time when Magical Mystery Tour was being filmed. So the reason why he's doing it, Ollie, is because his conscience is catching up with him. Yeah, I mean, he's going to go to his grave. He's going to go to his grave. You know, what's it going to say on it? Bill Shepard, 1937 to whenever it is he passes away. Well, who the hell is Bill Shepard? Is he the guy that did, you know, Billy Pepper and the Pepper Pots? He was in the band with Denny Lane, the Diplomats, back in the early 1960s. He was playing the role of Phil Ackrell at the time. He's played other roles. Vivian Stanshall was another part that he played. But his longest running and most involved role clearly has been Paul McCartney. So nobody knows who he is, and I guess it's catching up with him that he's realizing that nobody's going to know who Bill Shepard is, and he's the guy that had the talent, the skills, and has written all the songs since 1967, and nobody's going to know about it. So I guess it's kind of bugging.
Different issues over the years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's definitely an ego thing. Look, I mean, even a few years back, he wanted to change the song credits from Lennon and McCartney to McCartney and Lennon for those songs that he wrote. So in other words, let's just take a song, Let It Be. It says, Let It Be. Song credits, Lennon and McCartney. That's how we would see it today. He wanted it to be, Let It Be, song credits, McCartney and Lennon. So even little things like that, he's trying to tweak it. He's trying to revise history because it's like, well, I wrote that song. John Lennon didn't write that song. Why is Lennon's name first? Well, it's first because in the early days, that's the agreement they came to when they did the song credits. It was going to be Lennon and McCartney, and it was done alphabetically. But Shepard, over time, was starting to get very antsy about the fact that he wasn't getting his due. Never mind the fact that he's gotten extremely wealthy. Extremely wealthy from impersonating somebody else, but yeah. He still wants to have his cake and eat it too. So it's a gigantic ego thing, in my view.
The night when it is said that Paul died, that is the exact point where suddenly Beatles, from touring and playing live and giving live interviews, they just stop more or less overnight. Boom.
Right. That's because if he got on stage, Shepard's not a small man. He's tall. So if he had gotten on stage, it would have been a lot easier for folks to take a look and say, boy, would he have a growth spurt? You know. So they wanted to avoid that. They also wanted to avoid public appearances for a period of time until they got him to the point where they felt comfortable that he could pass for Paul McCartney. And he mentions this in the book, by the way. He mentions that he had some interactions with people and he was nervous about the fact that, you know, are people going to figure this out? I mean, do I look enough like him or, you know? And then he realized that, you know, people weren't questioning it. So his confidence started to really build because people weren't stopping and saying, gee, you don't really look like him. Are you really Paul McCartney? I mean, they just went with it. He's Paul McCartney. So, yeah, so they halted the appearances, the concerts and all that stuff because, look, they had to give it some time for the surgeries and the fillers to do what they had to do
but
in order to get him to the point where they felt
break
he
up
close enough that he can get by
and get rid of the butler and all of these type of things. Anyone that could recognize him close up. Yeah.
Yeah, Jane Asher. Yeah, so that's another thing I get asked a lot. People will say, well, so all these people were in on it? Well, you have to understand that all of these people that we're talking about are people that they play in the upper echelon or in the elite realms. That includes the Ashers. And Jane Asher knew that it wasn't Paul McCartney, and she was asked to play along. and they played along for a while. And of course, you know, he met Linda Eastman at the time, who became Linda McCartney. And of course, the Eastmans are, you know, very wealthy, and they play in that world of the elite. So, you know, we're talking about, again, we're getting back into secret societies. We're talking about Freemasonry. I believe that biological Paul's father was a high-level Freemason. In the book, he mentions that Shepard met with the McCartneys very soon after. It was like a day or two after McCartney allegedly passed away. And his family was receptive. And they said they were going to be supportive. In fact, they were going to, they gave him some of Paul's clothes, and under the premise that Shepard was going to continue their son's legacy. That was the premise that was put forth in the book, if I had to, you know, just summarize it. But how does that happen? I mean, how does a family who's supposed to be mourning their son, if he did indeed pass away, have this stranger walk into their house a day or two later and like, oh, by the way, I'm going to replace your son. He's there with Brian Epstein. How do you take that in? How do you embrace that as a family after your son passed away? You know, something just smells very, very fishy about that whole story. And so, you know, my view is that, well, there's a lot more to it. And I believe a lot more to it is the fact that there's this whole Masonic tie into this thing, and that everybody was looped in, and that this was something that was destined to happen.
A lot of money can sometimes sort these types of problems out as well.
Well, he says that in the book. He says that they did have to pay people off, but he claims a lot of people didn't have to be paid off. And that's because, the people that are in this world, Ollie, they are all playing in the same game. One of the questions I used to ask was, well, how did engineers, producers, and other bands not call it out? Well, it's because all these people are, they're in the same club. In the book, he mentions that the Stones were, you know, completely in the know on this thing. The Who were completely in the know. Donovan, Elton John knew because Lennon had told him what had gone down. In fact, in the book, he says that Jagger was very upset by the whole thing, and not because, I guess, that in a sense that Paul was replaced, because they're all playing a part. They're all Freemasons, very high-level Freemasons. It was because Jagger didn't believe that Shepard had paid his dues, and that Jagger was actually waiting for Shepard to fall on his face. Flat on his face. And when it didn't happen, because let's face it, and a lot of people want to argue with me on this point because they just don't like the fact that biological Paul is replaced. That's how I kind of sum it up. But Bill Shepard's a very talented guy. I mean, the songs that he wrote from Sgt. Pepper on and into his solo career, I don't care what anybody says, I'll put that up against anybody out there from a songwriter and musician perspective. And this guy is like top shelf, okay? So when Shepard proved that he could do it, that he could write the songs, and that he was an outstanding musician and songwriter, these guys, then the respect was built. And so they were like, okay, all right, welcome to the club, Bill. Welcome. You know, you've proved yourself. It's good to have you. So all of these bands, they knew. He mentioned that he had very lengthy discussions with Donovan, as an example. Donovan knew. So the reason why it never leaked out was because all of these guys knew. Denny Lane knew. In fact, Denny Lane did an interview in August of 2016, Ollie, which was very telling. And in that interview, he basically, in so many words, says that biological Paul McCartney is not with us anymore, right? That Bill Shepard is the guy that we're calling Paul McCartney. So it's all coming out, you know? But again, the only way you're going to get it is if you know about it and you have an understanding and you start doing the research, and then you start to listen to what these guys are saying and you're reading what people are writing and you listen to Lennon's interviews going back in time, or as you mentioned with George Harrison, who called him Paul McCartney, I think two or three times in an Australian interview. it's all out there. What they do is they hide it in plain sight, Ollie. That's what they do. They put it out there knowing that most of the masses are profane. They don't know. They don't get it. They don't understand. So they can go about their business doing whatever it is they want to do. And for those people who do get it, those people are so small in population that group is just so tiny. They don't worry about us. They don't worry about you. They don't worry about me knowing this. It's like, whatever. Mike, talk about it till your face turns blue. We don't
I
care.
I think it's interesting that
because
both
most people are just
Elton John
not going to believe
Paul
you.
Paul McCartney have been knighted as well. By the English Queen, which when you
Yeah, McCarty's been knighted twice.
How is that possible?
Twice. Twice. Yeah, it wasn't good enough once. See, he's been around the block twice with the queen. Yeah. Nope. Yeah. Yeah, that's something that Mark Devlin brought to my attention. I thought he was knighted once, and then Mark said to me, "Mike, twice." And I'm like,
and
really?
Then
and I looked it up. I'm like, well,
thing,
I'll be.
For instance, when he came to Japan, I was taken for drugs, and it turned out that his fingerprints was not the same as the last time the authorities had taken his prints. There's also kids that says that the children are biological Paul McCartney. There's also a wife, like after Linda McCartney, there was a wife that went out, Heather Mills, big time, saying there's this
Heather Mills.
hideous secret that will explode in our face. Or she, please tell us about Heather Mills and what that was all about.
Heather Mills, those of us that are researching this, believe that Heather Mills had come across some information and figured it out. So I don't know if Heather Mills knew that he wasn't Paul McCartney when she married him, or maybe she did know and something else was found out. I can tell you that McCartney, the guy that we call McCartney, Shepherd, is heavily into occultism, Aleister Crowley, magic. This all comes out in the book. In fact, I mean, he talks about the fact that he leverages the magic. He leverages what we might refer to as Luciferianism or Satanism for financial gain and success. But he claims he's not a Satanist. So, I mean, it's like, you know, I want to have his cake and eat it too. But evidently, Heather Mills had come across some information and was unknowing that stunned her, and then she's like, okay, I'm done with this because, you know, you're not who you claim to be. Or Heather Mills knew who he was, that he wasn't Paul McCartney, and then when the marriage went south, she used that information as leverage in order to get something out of him. Because the payout that he paid to Heather Mills for that divorce settlement, I forgot what the number was, but it was huge. It was gigantic. So she really was telling everybody that there is something really, really foul about what's going on here. Okay, this guy that you guys all love called Paul McCartney is something that really is stinking the place up with him. So she was vilified ruthlessly in the British press. But, you know, she got her huge payout from the divorce settlement, and then we really don't hear from Heather anymore. I mean, she's gone. And that's because, you know, she and he can't talk about it anymore. In fact, in the book, Memoirs of Billy Shears, he doesn't talk about her at all. So I think what happened was, as part of the settlement, they had to completely subtract each other from each other's lives. Can't talk about it, didn't exist, didn't happen, boom. Just go on as if you guys never knew each other. And that's what we have today. But you talk about only, you know, there's close calls or the Japan thing. You're absolutely right. Different fingerprints from Interpol. And he was in a Japan prison for 9 days. And the way he got out was the UK government and Scotland Yard interceded. And they had placed a phone call and contacted the Japanese government. And that's how he was able to get out of that predicament. So we had the UK government and Scotland Yard interject on his behalf. There was also voice print analysis that was done in 1969 by Professor Dr. Henry Truby of the University of Miami. And he had done sonograms, which are voice prints, and he had proved that it cannot be the same person singing these songs that was supposedly being sung by Paul McCartney. And he did voice prints for Yesterday versus Penny Lane and Yesterday versus Hey Jude, and the voice prints did not match up. And it was published in Life magazine, I believe back in 1969, but it got very little fanfare and very little was paid attention to Dr. Truby's findings. And then he had the paternity suit in 1982 with Erika Hubers from Hamburg. She was with Biological Paul back in 1962, and the relationship was well established, and they had a daughter, Bettina Hubers. And she's married now. Her name is Bettina Crispin, if I'm not mistaken. But he was being taken to court for more child support. He was Shepard was paying the child support because what he was doing was he was honoring the contract between biological Paul McCartney and Erica Hubers for child support. And I guess one of the reasons why he honored that contract was because, well, how was he going to pull out? What was he going to say? I'm not Paul McCartney. So he played it out. But evidently, the child support was paid up to a certain point. Like in the United States, after age 18 in most states, you don't have to pay child support anymore. So I guess that was a very similar situation that had taken place with Bettina Hubers, who was the child. And they went to court and said, okay, look, you know what? You owe child support beyond the age of 18. And he had to submit DNA, which did not match. And so he was accused, Shepard was accused by the Hubers of, well, specifically the mother, Erica Hubers, of sending an imposter to go have the DNA test done. So what happened was this also segued into doing some handwriting analysis. And they found the German court that the signatures did not match. And this case dragged on forever and ever. And then it was abandoned in May of 2007 due to the statute of limitations for fraud expiring. And the statute of limitations in German law for fraud is 5 years. So what happened was, essentially, he played out the clock to the point where the Hubers couldn't do anything more with the case. And in the book, Memoirs of Billy Shears, Shepard says that any other case that comes up with regard to illegitimate children that were fathered by biological Paul, that he was just going to let the DNA play out. Because he knows the DNA is not going to match because he's not biological.
There's also some rumors saying that...
So, I mean, there are situations out there where she got very sticky for him.
Linda McCartney was blackmailing Fall into marrying her because she had found out. Is that something you've heard about?
Well, I don't know about the blackmailing part, but I had heard that she had of course, we don't know if this conversation really took place, but it's stated in other research that, you know, he took a fancy to her. He liked her. And she had said to him, I know who you are and I know who you are not. And of course, Linda Eastman, who later became Linda McCartney, she was a photographer. And she was taking many pictures of bands throughout that period. So, I mean, she had lots of pictures of the Beatles and other bands and band members and so on. So she knew he wasn't Paul McCartney. Now, whether she was blackmailing him or not, to be honest, Ole, I have a hard time with that because he speaks so fondly of her. I was asked this question before about the relationship with Linda McCartney. And I've got to tell you, everything I have seen between Shepard and Linda seems very genuine to me. So even though he's been playing a character for 50 years, it doesn't mean that he doesn't have real feelings and relationships and love for somebody. And, you know, he had children with Linda. And in fact, he quit playing the part of Vivian Stanshall back when Linda was diagnosed with cancer. He packed up that role. He stopped playing that in order to be able to look after her. So I don't know about the blackmail piece of it. I tend to not believe that. I believe that they were two people that really dug each other.
Well, I'm happy to hear
that. In love with
that,
each other.
Because
but that she knew that.
A conspiracy is one thing, but I love hearing good stuff as well. Mike, we're coming to the end, and I really, really want to thank you for taking the time. And could you please let our listeners know how they can contact you, if we can support you in any way or form? What do you want to achieve, and what are your plans for the future here? How do you see the world within the next 6 months?
Well, you can contact me again going to my hub website, sageofquaits, quay.com, and there you'll find all of my social media and my media outlets, my YouTube channel, Mixcloud, Twitter, and all that stuff. Also, you have there's a link there to my music. You can click there to take a look at the album, listen to some of the songs of the current album. The new album will be released later this year. What I hope to accomplish, Ole, is to continue to put the truth out there. As I mentioned to Anita Whitney the other day, I was on another show talking about a different topic. You know, it's like, and you know this, once you look past the curtain and you see what's behind the curtain, there's no way that you can go back. There's no way you can say, well, I'm going to go back and live in the false reality. I'm going to go back into the virtual reality, into the matrix. It's just not going to happen. So in my own way, I'm going to continue to put the shows out. I'm going to continue to do shows like this and present material like this, because it's very important that people understand that just about everything that we know is a lie. Or as I like to say, everything worth knowing is a lie. And where I see the world in 6 months from now, I think that we're going to continue to see the battle go on. It's a struggle between good and evil. That's what it is that we are fighting here. I know it sounds, maybe oversimplistic to a lot of people, but at the end of the day, when you boil it down, that's really what we're dealing with here. And people should not be deceived. They need to understand that the agenda that's in place, that hangs over humanity, is an anti-agenda humanity. It's not something that's there to benefit you or me or anybody else, and that in order for us to really have an existence that we really deserve as humans, as souls, we're going to have to take these forces on, and we're going to have to hit them head on, and we have to do it in a big way. One time I was asked why it is that evil seems to prevail all the time, and I explained to people it's because unlike good people, unlike people that are working within the light, within love, and all that, not to be light and love or new agey, but you know what I'm saying. Evil knows no boundaries. You see, good people know boundaries. Good people have boundaries. They won't step over certain lines, but evil doesn't have boundaries. So it doesn't blink when it has to go even further and further and further to do things which progresses their agenda. So we have to understand that as good people, as people who are seeking truth, we have to understand that that is what we're up against. So we have to really get tough, you know, and we have to push back in a big, big way and expose things if we expect to make the world a better place.
May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.
Sailors are we, when the ride, the astral.